We have been setting up the book of Leviticus in large part, looking at the structure of it, talking some about the theology of it, particularly in regard to the tabernacle. And we saw, of course, that the book of Leviticus is the legislation there. The laws are given to Israel at Mount Sinai during the construction of the tabernacle. Once the tabernacle is completed, then Leviticus comes into effect. Okay? And I've been arguing that Leviticus is largely about a reconciliation between God and man through means of the tabernacle worship. We saw that the tabernacle is it's a replica of the Garden of Eden. It is a portable Mount Sinai, a holy mountain of God, where a place where God's presence can dwell and man can draw near to God's presence. And Leviticus is the book that shows us the way back into the garden, into God's presence, so that we can have a meal with Him. And what we want to do to start with is show how, as we look at the introductory chapters of Leviticus, start to see how that took place by looking at the theology of the sacrifices and the consecration and inauguration of the priesthood, who are the mediators who perform the offerings or sacrifices. Since man is excluded from God's presence because of his sin, now he's going to be allowed limited access, but it's going to be through the mediation of another and through sacrifice. And so we have a new beginning for humanity. Okay, a new Garden of Eden. We're going to see the Aaron is going to be like a new Adam. And as we saw, the tabernacle, the instructions for the tabernacle came in seven speeches. We're going to see seven speeches for the direction or setting forth the instruction for the sacrifices. And then there's going to be seven steps for the consecration of the priesthood. All right? This is all about a new beginning for humanity. Okay. With that in mind, the thing I really want us to see today, so often when we think about the sacrifices, we limit it merely to this animal dying in the place of the worshiper. Okay? It receives the punishment of the worshiper. Okay? So that we're reconciled to God. Well, that's just a very small portion of what the sacrificial system is about. Okay? That's really just a means to an end. If you look at all the sacrifices, they're all about a journey. There's a geographical progression that takes place, and they're all about a journey into the presence of God. By not only the killing of that sacrifice, but also the consecration and transformation of that sacrifice. And in fact, we're going to see there are some theologians who question whether we should refer to Leviticus containing a sacrificial system, because more often than not, these things we call sacrifices are actually offerings, or literally near bringings. Okay. This is going to be all about drawing near to God. Once again, entering to His presence so that we can have a meal with Him. All right? In Roman number 2, letter B here, let me just read this. It says, "Hence, while atonement is often thought to be at the heart of the sacrificial system, it must be understood that atonement was actually more a means to an end, which ultimately resulted in fellowship and communion with God. This goes discernible in the English term atonement, or, you know, from which we get atonement, which etymologically indicates reconciliation between God and humanity." Okay? Notice, we talk about atonement, we're usually talking about the forgiveness of sins. We think of atonement in terms of sacrifice, and that's it. But you know, the reason the early translators, and I think Tyndale's the one who came up with this word, and then the King James translators came up with it, was to, you know, it's one of those words that were made to communicate the end result of that animal dying in the place of the worship, which is that we would might be at one with God. Now we're going to see atonement's another word we're going to have to get rid of. All right, just like whole burnt sacrifice, we need to get rid of that. I appreciate the idea of it, but when we speak of the Day of Atonement, it's really the Day of Coverings we're going to see. Okay, so that's one of those words that doesn't really translate the Hebrew very well. God blessed the first people who, you know, translation 101, right? The first people who translated the Bible into English, they were doing the best that they could. And of course, William Tyndale was a brilliant man, spoke like 8 languages or something like that. So we can appreciate the idea, and we can appreciate the goal and what that symbolizes, but we're going to have to look at some words differently. All right. What I mean by that is this. The word sacrifice in the Bible is the word we translate sacrifice. And then we're going to see there's a series of words used for these things we call sacrifices. A sacrifice, more specifically, is an offering that results in a meal. And if it doesn't result in a meal, then it's more properly referred to as an offering. Okay, because the goal is the meal. Now, some scholars say, well, it's okay to call all these sacrifices because many of these offerings, they lead to and result in a meal. So it is a sacrificial system. But from a more technical perspective, a sacrifice is an offering that results in a meal. And usually, and I've got this list up here again of the major sacrifices. Again, on the left hand side, on the left hand side, we have sort of the traditional names, and then on the right hand side, we have some the names that we're going to try to learn progressively. Usually when the Bible speaks of a sacrifice, it's that third one down there, the peace offering. Okay? And that's the one in which the worshiper gets to eat part of the meal. Alright? So these other things are more often referred to as offerings. Okay? Like if we just open up Leviticus 1, now the Lord called to Moses, spoke to him from the tabernacle meeting, saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when any one of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of the livestock, of the herd, and of the flock. If the offering is a burnt sacrifice of the herd, if the offering is a ascension of the herd, let him offer a male without blemish, etc. Notice that word offering, okay? That word offering is the word korban. And oftentimes we translate that as a gift, but it's a gift that is that has been brought near to God. And what I mean by that is this. I've shared with you in the past, most Hebrew words have 3 consonant root. Okay? And what you do is the original manuscripts, there are no vowels. It's all consonants. You pronounce the vowels. You don't write the vowels. Okay? And depending on how you pronounce the vowels, then you change the meaning of the word. Okay? And words that are related will tend to keep those 3 letters. Now, I'll give you the illustration that Hebrew goes right to left. And this is a Y sound, an L sound, and a That is yalad. It means to give birth. Okay? Yalad. You get a Y sound, an L sound, a D sound. Now, if you give birth to a boy, it's a yelid. You still get the Y, the L, and the D, right? You give birth to a daughter, it's a yalda. There's actually a little H on the end of it now. So you got yalad, you're going to give birth to a little baby boy, it's a yelid. You give birth to a daughter, it's a yalda. If you give birth to daughters, it's yaldot. We make it plural. And if you want to talk about your generations, like these are the generations of Adam, it's toledot. Okay? So we drop the Y, you add a little T, but you still keep the L and the D. So you got all these words that are related. Yalad, yelid, yalda, yaldot, toledot, etc. We see this in, if you were saying goodbye to a Jew or greeting a Jew, you might say what? Shalom. Okay? Three consonants, S, H, L, and an M, right? Shalom. Okay? Solomon in Hebrew is Shlomo. S, H, L, M. You just got different vowels, right? Shir Hasharim HaShlomo. The Song of Songs of Solomon. Alright, the peace offering is Shalamim. S-H-L-M. And it's always offerings. That im sound makes it a masculine plural. Alright, so you got Solomon, you got Shalom, you got peace offerings. Shalom, Shlomo, Shalamim, etc. Alright? Well, the word korban, gift, and it would be, it's like a Q sound, an R sound, and a B sound. We would do it like this. Okay? That word korban is related to the word kerib, which means to draw near, and karab, which means in the midst of. And so these things we call offerings are literally near bringings. See? They're near bringings. We're drawn near to God through these what we call sacrifices. And that word goes back and forth in Leviticus 1. When any one of you draws near and brings a near bringing to the Lord, an offering, you shall kerib your korban. You shall, bring your offering of the livestock. Okay? So these are things that are ultimately drawn near because that's the goal. We want to draw near to God. We want to have fellowship with Him as we were originally intended. Okay? And that's what is symbolized in these offerings. And letter D down here says, by offering an animal, the Israelite worshiper is offering himself to God. This is the gift that God really wants. Remember, God wants obedience, not sacrifice. So that's why when a faithful Israelite brings an animal near, he is in effect drawing near through the animal in order to offer himself to the Lord. So that's the goal of what we call the sacrificial system. It's about the forgiveness of sin through the shedding of a blood of a substitute. But it's so that we can get back in the garden, have a meal with God like we were supposed to. Okay? Let me just stop right there. Any kind of questions about that so far? Yes, sir.
Going back to what you said, wait, I missed it, but you said that there were seven speeches with instructions on the building of the tabernacle. Then you said seven something else, and I'm just hanging on to that number seven because the number of God, the number of weakness. But what were those other things that you mentioned?
There's seven speeches. There's actually nine speeches altogether in Leviticus 1 to 7. But there's seven speeches about the instructions for the sacrifices. And then there's seven steps to the consecration of the priesthood. Okay? And he's gonna start his job on the eighth day. You know, the day of circumcision, the day of new beginnings, the day after the Sabbath, so to speak. All right, so this is all a new creation, new Garden of Eden, new Adam, new access to God, all that. Yes, sir.
So in English, when it translates atonement, what did you say the better word was?
Covering. Yom Kippur. Do you hear about? You'll see this on your calendar sometimes in September. Yom Kippur means Day of Atonement. That's how we translate it. But it's Day of Coverings, actually. Okay. Think about Adam and Eve. They sin. What they do? They try to cover themselves up with fig leaves, and God gave them animal sacrifices instead. You got to be covered up, and that's really what it's. That's a better. And because we're covered up, then we can be at one with God. So you can understand how.
Again, I think it was Tyndale. Don't hold me to that, but I think it was Tyndale who came up with that word. Yeah.
Again, I think I missed this too. The point you're making about the Greek words, is what again?
That word korban, which is the word, like Jesus talks about the Pharisees. The Pharisees were scoundrels, and they got on Jesus because. They got on Jesus because he didn't keep the traditions and washing his hands. And he said, you nullify the commandments by your traditions. And he gave an example. He said, the commandment says honor your father and mother. But you say korban and you don't do that. What the Pharisees would do, they would dedicate their belongings to the temple. And so they got to enjoy their, I guess like a reverse mortgage or something. They got to enjoy their belongings until they die. But then when their aged parents needed help, they said, sorry, this is dedicated to God. This is korban. It's a gift dedicated to God. And so can't help you. It was just a way for them to violate the commandment. And so that word korban, which is related to the verb kerev, you get those same consonants, the Q, the R, the V, which means to draw near. And karab means in the midst of. So it's a near brain. We translate it gift a lot of times. What did you say, Ken?
Like
I have to think about that. I don't know where that comes from. All right. So this offering is about drawing near to God. That's what we want to do. And that's what this is designed to lead us to, is to draw near to God, to have a meal with Him. Okay. So what I really want us to see is that this sacrificial system is about a whole lot more than just some animal dying in the place of the sinner. That animal dies in the place so that we can draw near, so we can have fellowship. All right. Yeah, Ken.
So, me and Deborah had this discussion about that first, a little bit of, the emphasis on the meal was kind of foreign to us, you know, kind of thing. But then I came to, I had an epiphany, it was like, well, it was a meal, so to speak, by eating the fruit that the serpent offered that separated us from God. So it makes sense.
Meals are all about covenants.
Right. The bread and all that.
It's all about covenants. Exactly. And, most, a
lot of theologians believe that the reason why we have two trees pointed out is those are sacramental trees. The tree of life, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And originally it says, every tree shall be food for you. Okay? They're gonna have to wait though. Alright? And they gotta get things in order. They gotta get tree of life and then tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Okay? It's only after Adam and Eve sinned that they're cast out of the garden and prohibited back to the tree of life. In the new covenant, in the old covenant, you had a sacrament of initiation, circumcision, a sacrament of renewal, Passover. In the new covenant, we have a sacrament of initiation, baptism, sacrament of renewal, Lord's Supper. So the inference is, if we read back into the garden, then we have two sacraments there. Do you have something?
Yes. The idea that Adam and Eve were being tested. coming to a trial period.
Mm-hmm.
They were supposed to follow God's instructions and not take that tree until he told them to.
Right.
Where do you read that in Genesis? I can't read that. I read Genesis, but I don't understand from reading Genesis that they're under a probationary period. How did that develop?
I think that a test is put there who you're going to believe. I mean, it's always been about faith. Adam and Eve, I think it's inferred by the fact God says, don't eat of this tree, lest you die. So whenever you see a command and sanctions, people usually infer there's a covenant involved. God gives commands and then he attaches sanctions or blessings, rewards and curses. Then we infer that there is a covenant. And so, I think that's, let me think about that more. I will say that Hosea 6 says that you all like Adam have broken the covenant. That it infers that there was a covenant there, that by implication, not of works. Now, there's all this debate about that. I don't think Adam was supposed to earn God's favor. Adam was already God's son, and God had blessed them and told them to be fruitful and multiply. Grace comes first. And so the question was whether Adam was going to respond in faith to God's graciousness or not. That was the test placed before him. And so he ate of the forbidden fruit. That's because he had already in his heart, the sin was present there. The sin was present when he allowed the serpent into the garden to tempt his wife. Real fast. I'm going to have to get back to the sacrifices. Yeah, thank you.
I kind of had the same question. And does it say you can eat of all the trees? First it says you can eat of all the trees.
Mm-hmm.
But the tree is in the midst. So there is kind of a sense that there was a time when they would be able to eat of all the trees.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. What we see the rest of the place in Scripture, the knowledge of good and evil has to do with maturity. It has to do with passing, rendering judgment and so forth. All those under the age of 20, Deuteronomy 139, they were not able to go into the promised land because they could not discern good and evil. Solomon becomes king. And he's an adult, but he says, I'm a child. I cannot discern good and evil. Hebrews 5:14 speaks about those who, through use of their senses, are mature and can discern good or evil. And Adam and Eve were going to be enthroned, but not yet. Okay? As one person puts it, Adam was 14 years old. He took the car keys and he, took the car for a spin. All right. Well, let's get back here, Roman number 3 at the bottom of that first page. And again, I'm wanting you to see the fullness of the sacrificial system. I'll just read this letter A. While Exodus closed with the inaccessibility of God in his dwelling, Leviticus opens with divine legislation aimed at allowing Israel to draw near and commune with God. The basic rites of the sacrificial system demonstrate this fact by an examination of the 6 major steps involved in the animal offerings. All right, what we mean by that is this. You remember, Exodus comes to a close. The tabernacle is complete. The glory of God enters into the tabernacle, and it's like, this is wonderful. But all of a sudden we said, but Moses can't go in. What are we going to do? Well, Moses could go up on the mountain with God, and now he can't. Now that God's presence has entered the tabernacle, well, how are we going to get in? Okay? And so now Leviticus is going to show us the way. And it begins then by setting forth the major sacrifices. Before we look at the major sacrifices, what I want to do is look at the sacrificial rituals or offering the rituals, okay? And some people say there are five major rights. Others say there are six. For the sake of thoroughness, I'm going to say there's six, okay? There are six major steps that the priest and the worshiper goes through in general in offering these rites. Now, there's variations, okay? And we'll talk about those variations when we get to the individual sacrifices. But there's a basic procedure. And at first, it sounds like a lot of stuff, but it's like, you know, any of our jobs, if you do it every day, right? You know, it's not so hard. You can do it kind of mindlessly. And that's the thing. We have to remember when you come to Leviticus and you're reading all those details about the grain offering, if it's this kind of grain offering, you know, you and salt or, you know, oil, or if it's this kind of grain offering, then something else. If you did that every day, you wouldn't have to think about this like the Levites would and so forth. All right? And what you had to do is just bring, you had to know what to bring. Okay? But what I want us to see is there's six basic steps. We're going to get through, oh, Lord willing, three, hope, maybe four. Nah, ain't going to happen. Three today. Seth wants music. All right. So let's go through these. So you're an ancient Israelite. You're bringing an animal to offer to God. Here's what you go through. First of all is what we might call the presentation rite. And that's not initially set forth. This is the one that sometimes people omit. But later on, like you get to Leviticus 22 and 70, you get all this description about what you got to go through. But this is the reason I wanted to include this is because it teaches us something really important. You bring your animal to the
doorway here to the court here in the courtyard. Of course, only one door, only one way to God, and faces eastward, right? You bring it here to the gate, so to speak.
The priest takes a look at it. Make sure that it is without blemish. All right? Now, the reason why, you know, Jesus talked about the Pharisees making things a den of thieves, they had a racket going on. If you're in Galilee and you got this choice lamb and you got to travel 3 days down to Jerusalem, that animal may start out with a blemish. By the time you get it down there to Jerusalem, it may not be. And so it wasn't unreasonable for the priest or for the temple system to have animals that are already, you know, like being pre-approved for a loan or something, right? Okay, so these animals are already pre-approved without blemish. Now, we get the impression that the priest took advantage of things. And there was always a temptation here. You know, this prize sheep here, do you really want to bring it? There'd be a temptation to maybe bring kind of a defective one instead of the good one. And there would be a temptation for the priest to overlook it, maybe for a bribe. You know, when Malachi talks about this, about the kind of sacrifices Israel's offering, they're not offering their best and stuff. So there's always a pastoral moment there when the person appears there with this animal. Well, the person presents this animal to the priest, and that animal has to be without blemish. Okay? Now, what's significant about this that is so important? And this, one of these days, a couple thousand years from now, we're going to have translations that bring all this stuff out. All right? The word for without blemish is the exact same, and when used in regard to animals, when used in regard to humans, is always the word blameless. Okay, so that animal is blameless, right? It's like it's a sinless substitute, so to speak. So you can see how it's pointing forward to Jesus, right? But it's also used to describe godly people in the Bible. And here again, our translations prevent us from bringing this out because we're so, you know, especially because we believe in total depravity, we can't say anybody's blameless. Well, of course we believe in total depravity, but God overcomes our total depravity and He makes us blameless, right? There is no condemnation to those who are in Christ Jesus. Okay? So we have people in Scripture that are referred to as blameless. Noah is blameless before God. Didn't mean he never sinned, but when he sinned, what did he do? You know, he offered the right sacrifice, he confessed, whatever. And so he was blameless in God's sight. God tells Abraham, walk blameless before me. Be without blemish. Toby Sumter, in his commentary on Job, makes the point that when Job opens up, we read about Job and we're told he's blameless. And again, the same word there, he's like an unblemished sacrifice. So Toby Sumter says, well, of course Job's going to go through this ordeal because he is a sacrificial animal, right? He is an appropriate sacrificial animal. Because that's what God does, see? We're going to see, you got unclean animals, you got clean animals, then you got sacrificial animals. And the sacrificial animals represent Israel. Israel's supposed to be, live sacrificially for the sake of the world. What does God do? He sacrifices himself for us so that we might be reconciled to him. And then we're supposed to offer ourselves up as sacrifice for others. He makes us blameless so that we can sacrifice on behalf of others, that they might also experience, you know, reconciliation to God. Sumter points out in the book of Romans, you know, there's all this talk about justification throughout the book, how God's going to justify the Gentiles and the Jews, etc. And, you know, we focus on that especially because of all the debates about justification in the Reformation. And then we get to chapter 12. Therefore, offer yourselves up as living sacrifices. That's kind of an afterthought. Okay, now he switches over to application. And Sumter says, no, that's the whole point. All that talk about justification is leading up to, therefore, God has made you blameless without blemish. Therefore, offer yourselves up as living sacrifices. All right, so the point is, God, the presentation right, the animal is without blemish. And being without blemish symbolizes the morally blameless life, which was the prerequisite for approaching God. Because that's ultimately the goal, right? Who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell in your holy hill? He who walks uprightly and works righteousness and speaks the truth in his heart, etc. He who does not backbite at his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor does take reproach against his friend, etc. Who can ascend to the hill of God? The one who is blameless, the one who is justified. Okay. So that's the first right. And we'll just get here today then. We started 5 minutes late. I can go 5 minutes. All right. Next is the hand-leaning right. All right. Say hand-leaning because you put hands. Okay. So now let's say your animal here has, so now you put your hands on the head of the animal and you push down hard. All right? Now, it's been a long time since we haven't talked about this, but I've taught you all wrong in the past. What's the comments from the peanut gallery here? We're not paying attention. All right. The result of the rite now is that the animal is a substitute for the worshiper. Okay? I've pointed this out before, but there's been some misunderstandings in regard to what happens later. What I mean by that is, when you're trying to figure out, there's debate among theologians, what happens when the worshiper puts their hands on the head of the animal? Well, the best explanation is that animal is essentially being ordained, so to speak. Throughout the rest of Scripture, the placing of hands on a person consecrates them to a position, appoints them to an office or something, so that they can act on behalf of others. Okay? So what you do with the animal is like what you do when a person becomes an elder, you know, you lay hands on them, right? Because now they're gonna live sacrificially. They're supposed to, because that's what leaders are supposed to do in the Bible. Supposed to serve. Okay. So at the bottom of number 3 here, C3 says the passage cited to demonstrate that the hand leaning right was a declaration that the animal is taking place at the worshiper, so that the worshiper will ascend into God's presence through the blameless substitute. Okay? Now, there is an alternate interpretation to this that I have, you know, I've been taught and I've taught you all that I don't think's right anymore. In the Day of Atonement rite, we are told that when the worshiper, or excuse me, the priest in this case, places hands upon the scapegoat, he transfers the sin of Israel onto the scapegoat. Okay? And Aaron shall lay both his hands on the head of the live goat, confess over it all the iniquities of the children of Israel and all their transgressions concerning all their sins, putting them on the head of the goat, and shall send it away into the wilderness by the hand of the suitable man. The goat shall bear on itself all their iniquities to an uninhabited land, and he shall release the goat in the wilderness. Okay, in that rite, the sins of Israel are placed on the scapegoat. Okay, and that's why a lot of times people, and why I always believe that part of what was happening by that laying on of hands was that the sins of the person were being placed on the animal. Okay, and what I'm suggesting now is that's not the case. It's more of an ordination, and I'll just read 4a here and b. It says, it is true that on the Day of Atonement, sin is transferred to the scapegoat in a parallel ritual. However, once Israel's sins are symbolically transferred to the scapegoat, it is not sent into God's presence, but rather is sent outside the camp into the wilderness. This is because once the transfer of sin has taken place, the scapegoat is no longer worthy to be brought into the divine presence. See, if you're placing, why does this animal have to be blameless? Well, it's got to be blameless so that it can ascend into God's presence. If it's got all that sin on it now, it can't ascend into God's presence. And at letter B here says, by contrast, since the sacrificial animal is still regarded as blameless and holy after the hand-leaning rite, it strongly suggests that a transfer of sin would seem to defeat the purpose of the animal being blameless and thereby able to ascend into God's presence. Okay, so the only time we're told sin is placed on the animal is in the case of the scapegoat, which specifically is not sent into God's presence. The scapegoat is sent out of God's presence, out into the wilderness. So that would mean in a usual sacrifice or offering, what is happening is that animal is being appointed as a substitute for the worshiper. The animal represents the worshiper, who's going to die on behalf of the worshiper, who's going to be transfigured into smoke. He's going to become godlike, right? God's going to dwell above the tabernacle in this glory cloud. And that animal then is going to be transfigured, and it's going to ascend into God's presence. And that's why that what we call the whole burnt offering is literally the ascension offering. Okay? Because that's where we're getting to. The animal's going to ascend into God's presence.